So first of all, let me just say it's a real honor to be with you all and to be part of these discussions. Great session last time. I now have to kind of redo the exact same thing I just did, which is sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't go well, but we'll see how it goes. But again, it's a real honor to be with you all. So I'm going to talk about strategic foresight and futurist thinking a bit in this session. I do want to sort of give a quick disclaimer that while I am a Christian, this does not come from any consciously Christian point of view. There's no Bible verses or anything like that in this work. This is just good old-fashioned strategic planning and business thinking, but work that I think has tremendous value, particularly in what I think Jim Collins calls values-based enterprises, but organizations that actually have the opportunity to stitch together different values to deliver something that meets real need. And again, I know that sounds a little bit convoluted, but I think as we go through this, hopefully you'll feel very energized by the work you're doing, and hopefully also leave with a handful of tools in the tool belt that you can bring back to your institution or organization to really begin to engage in newer and in some cases more progressive forms of strategic planning or strategic insight, which we certainly think have a lot of value. So again, I'm from Southern New Hampshire University. We are a nonprofit, primarily online university based obviously in New Hampshire. We currently serve about 135,000 learners across several different modalities, largely online and largely working adults. We also have a very, very traditional kind of residential campus in New Hampshire that serves sort of your conventional 18 to 24-year-old, but our growth story has largely been through online learning. Everything we do is about scale and maximizing impact, and the work that I get to do every day is kind of overseeing that effort. I lead the innovation and strategy arm of the university. It's a center we actually call the Sandbox Collaborative. We focus on a lot of kind of early stage research and development around new and promising concepts and learning models for higher education, in addition to providing business intelligence and strategic insight to the university on the whole. So that's kind of what I do. I do have a seminary degree, so I should point that out. And so I do this work. It's a Calvinist seminary. I'm sorry. I'm not a Calvinist, but kind of have done that work. I used to teach at Gordon College up on the North Shore in Boston area. So I've kind of been in your world. I get it. I understand its opportunities and its challenges. And again, hopefully we'll just kind of offer something that will be of value. Sound good? Everybody good? Right? Your pretzels and coffee and everyone's all energized. All right, so let me just kind of show you a few things. So first of all, when we do this work, these are facts. So when at SNHU we look at new programs, when we think about the future, these are not things that we debate. So when we think about the future of learning, we have several facts in mind. Learning is increasingly a lifelong endeavor. It is not just something we do between the ages of 18 to 24. It really never was, actually, historically, but it's sort of the paradigm that we have in our mind about what college looks like and all of this. So all of this is changing all around us and actually has been changing for several decades now. The need to build ecosystems of learning, what we often refer to as just-in-time learning experiences that meet learners where they are and provide them what they need, is very much within the DNA of higher education today and its growth trajectory. Learning is happening everywhere. You can like this or not. You compete with YouTube far more than you think you do as an institution, and you're never going to change that. In fact, that is going to get worse if you think of it as a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. But the opportunity to provide what really amounts to scaled learning interventions online has obviously exploded over the years, and is really fundamentally changing, some people would say, kind of, quote, disrupting the way in which people learn, the way in which we take in information. Learning is increasingly digital. Digital, by the way, is not synonymous with online. Online refers to a particular modality where you're basically taking conventional education and delivering it through a wire. That's largely what SNHU does today, but we are very clued into the fact that learning is becoming increasingly a digital experience. It's a stitching together of various tools and technologies, increasingly enabled by things like artificial intelligence and machine learning, to increase the pace by which we can deliver solutions and scale what we deliver. And so Learning is increasingly digital. I often tell institutions we work with or that I work with or that I talk to or friends or colleagues in the industry, stop saying online learning. Really what we're talking about is being in an environment of digital education or digital learning, and it's an important difference to draw. Learning is increasingly practical. This is the one that everyone really loves to debate. A few months ago, I spoke at a conference with liberal arts professionals or, you know, professors and presidents, and everyone wants to debate this, right? So, whoa, wait a second. We're here at our institution, we care about deep learning. We really, you know, we're reading Aristotle, and okay, that's great. That can also be very practical. Right? So learning is increasingly aligned to the context of meaning in our learners' lives. And it just so happens that that tends to be the workplace. Right? So to say that higher education needs to be better aligned to the workforce, I think is an understatement. I think higher education needs to work in complete concert with the workforce to prepare our students to go on to live meaningful and productive lives. Learning is also increasingly personalized. That's not the same as individualized. There's a very big difference there. Again, personalization means meeting learners where they are and providing them with the solution that they need to achieve their goals, right? So that often means rethinking, reconfiguring the way our institutions are currently run, the way that we teach, the technologies we use, the subject matter, et cetera, to better meet learners where they are. So I want to start with that, recognizing that some of this may be a little controversial. Some of you may disagree with that, or some of you may be nodding your head aggressively in agreement and thinking, why don't we all just do this and get on with it? The bottom line is, if we understand these to be the future of learning, this is undergirded by several key issues and assumptions. So first of all, when we look out to the future of higher education, we know that there are several things that are happening around us. These are the environmental factors. All of these in some way impact your institution. They impact your job. They impact the industry in which we're in. Real rapid changes in consumer behavior. A term that we often use is this notion of the omni-channel consumer. It is that your learners, and so, you know, particularly a traditional undergraduate student, is used to, in a given day, traversing between YouTube, Wikipedia, Amazon, a game they might be playing, right? And sort of all of these, what are really amount to consumer-grade, highly scaled digital experiences. And then they walk into your registrar's office, and they have to fill out a piece of paper, right? This practice is increasingly at odds with the way in which consumers behave today. Now, we can debate whether students are consumers or whether they're not. Bottom line is you're selling a product and they're buying it. And so increasingly institutions are having to align to market demand. I won't go through each of these. I think we're certainly aware of, you know, changing economic conditions. An imminent recession in this country could have a very significant impact on the world of higher education. What that looks like is very difficult to predict. Because of things like shifting demographics, it actually makes the likelihood of what people sometimes refer to as the counter-cyclical relationship between education and the economy much more problematic. So people will often say, for example, that when the economy is really bad, people go back to school to better their lives. When the economy is really good, higher education enrollments go down. That's actually what fueled a lot of the growth in online education for several years, but that paradigm is actually eroding quite a bit. Why? Because people are having less kids, and particularly in the Midwest and where we are in the Northeast, there's actually just fewer consumers to go around. So it's putting a lot of pressure on colleges to be very entrepreneurial. Political stability, I think that's kind of a given. Impending reauthorization of the Higher Ed Act, what happens to the future of the credit hour, Title IX, Title IV, everything you can imagine really has a significant impact on higher education, as well as new competitors. And I am sorry to say that SNHU may be one of those, so sorry. The institutions that, you know, most institutions in this country are now having to grapple with a whole new set of competitors. Now all of a sudden you're competing with a boot camp in town that is, you know, it's kind of teaching skills in sort of a just-in-time format, delivering micro-certifications, online learning programs, corporate learning programs, corporations that are now saying, I'm not going to work with a college. Why? Because they don't change. I'm going to build my own college and building kind of these in-house training units. All of this is really putting significant pressure on institutions. So what does this mean? Like, what do you do with this? right? So we could easily do what I call, we could all sit around the room and do what I call admiring the problem. So we could all sit back and go, whoa, this is really hard, guys. And let's just sit here and let's just complain about the demography for the next 45 minutes, high five, and I'll go home. What I want to present to you today is actually a very constructive way forward, a way that you can actually get out of the kind of doom and gloom that surrounds a lot of these realities and really start to construct a strategy and a narrative for your institutions or organizations to actually push yourselves forward. The way in which you do that is by getting into a futures mindset. So I want everyone to do me a favor. Close your eyes. It's kind of like we're at church and you do something. So I'm not going to have anyone raise their hand. I want you to imagine, so it's 2019. So imagine, I want you to imagine the year 2029. So 10 years from now. So you're 10 years older. Sorry. If you have kids, they are now 10 years older. So I have a 5-year-old, Miles, and a 2-year-old, Nolan. So Miles is going to be 15 years old. So like, what does Miles' world look like? What's he doing every day? What are you doing every day? You're going to go to the grocery store. Think about what the grocery store might look like. You're going to drive. What does that look like, right? To really try to imagine what this world looks like. Okay, so just for some input here, and this is where, you know, kind of share out, what are you picturing in the year 2029? What does it look like to you? What does it feel like? Any ideas? A lot of automation, yeah. Process automation, jobs, daily routines and tasks. What else? What else are you seeing?
A lot more autonomy and a lot more transience.
Okay. Yep. More transience. Okay. So let's say I owned several large kind of properties in the Orlando area. I would be very concerned right now, right? Let's say I owned a transportation and shipping company. That could be an interesting trend, right? Let's say, do you see where I'm going with this, right? So all these trends, and again, what we want to start doing is kind of think, well, what does that mean, right? What would that mean for you? What would that mean for a college, right? If people are increasingly more transient, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? What we want to do is kind of work on how would you craft an approach and a point of view to that. Other thoughts? So people often talk about a lot of technology kind of in the mix. So here's the danger in this, is that we can quickly devolve into science fiction. All right. So even when you saw the title for this, you might have thought, oh my goodness, who's this crazy person and what is he going to talk to us about? Oftentimes when you talk about futurism, when you talk about these kinds of things, it immediately conjures up all these bizarre thoughts of flying drones and all these kind of things. That is not at all what we are talking about. All we're talking about when we talk about foresight and future strategy is essentially a business planning method that you can employ to allow the institution or allow your organizations to think more meaningfully and critically about what your future might be. So it's not unlike some kind of what you would call conventional strategic planning methods, but as you're going to see here in a moment, it's a bit more progressive. Make sense? Thoughts, comments before we keep going? Okay, so why focus on the future? Well, the first thing is that whether you realize it or not, all of us have what we call cognitive anchoring in the past. We often will default back to or construct reality around things that we know, things that we've experienced. This is actually a very common behavior in higher education. You go back to your school, and you want it to look like it did the year that you went there, right? So again, if you're managing donors or, you know, kind of a philanthropy arm, this is actually a real problem for you. Why? Because people show up and they want it to look exactly how they did when they went there. Well, the problem is you got to change, right? You got to embrace more technology. There might be more automation. There might be buildings that you don't need anymore. There might be new buildings that you need. But the bottom line is we all kind of have this cognitive anchoring in the past. This is a real problem. It's a major problem. And I guarantee you, if you were to take the temperature around the table, even in kind of an average meeting, you would find that most people end up falling back on not just what they know, but what they've experienced, because it's very kind of precious and sacred to them. Now, this is not, by the way, if you're a futurist, that doesn't mean that you don't care about history. In fact, that you care about history more when you do this, but it does mean that you don't simply default back to that. So this allows you to push past biases. Oftentimes we have a lot of what we call implicit bias, particularly when we're thinking about the future of an institution or an organization. We have a very narrow point of view about what that could or could not be. And allowing yourself to get into a futures mindset actually neutralizes that conversation. It allows you to also look past an expected future. And what I mean by this is simply that all of you, if you think about the institutions you represent, you probably have a point of view about what that institution will look like 10 years from now. It may be a very positive point of view. It may be a very negative point of view. The bottom line is you don't actually know. None of us do. So what do you do with that? Well, you need an exercise. You need a framework. You need a mindset to get out of that in a way and to be more creative and to be more constructive. It also allows you to imagine what we call alternative realities. So we do a lot of this at SNHU, and we have for quite some time. So I could imagine an alternative reality where, so we are a nonprofit institution of higher education. That is our business, right? We compete in a market that has a very, at least it did, have a very large number of for-profit institutions. So University of Phoenix, et cetera, right? So we have a challenge, actually, that we grapple with a lot at SNHU. We do not, as a nonprofit entity, have access to private equity and capital in the way that the for-profit industry does, right? So in the event that there was a political change and a policy change that enabled for-profit education to grow again, we would actually be in a lot of trouble, right? So now I have a couple of alternative realities in front of me. So let's imagine scenario one, for-profits resurge, what do we do? Scenario two, for-profits go nowhere, what do? Right? You have to be prepared for that so that you're not surprised, right? So we run these scenarios and what we call alternative realities so that we can get our people ready. So when that happens, you go, ah, we're ready for that, right? Well, we've got this, you know, this kind of new thing. You know, state systems are, you know, now developing online programs and they're stealing 15% of our market share. Already one step ahead of you, right? Know what we're going to do. We have a plan. And then finally, it allows you to be part of shaping the future. We had a pretty robust discussion about this last time. If you do not, and this always sounds a little bit cliche, if you do not shape your future, somebody else will. Particularly from the vantage point of higher education, your future is actually being reshaped right now, whether you know it or like it or appreciate it or not. There are several very systemic, highly scaled forces out there that are changing, not just the way people learn, but the value proposition of learning, the value proposition of knowledge. If you even think about forces like Amazon. So let's think about this for a moment. Amazon has grown from an online bookseller to an online retailer and has recently acquired Whole Foods. So they're now in the food business, right? And has recently now adopted practices to get into kind of what you would call healthcare innovation. So if you notice the recent partnership with Berkshire Hathaway and J.P. Morgan to now basically get into the healthcare business. So it's very logical that Amazon, once they cut their teeth in the healthcare business, will then move into the education business. Right? So what does that mean for us? Right? So I manage a team of research associates and they produce reports and we do a lot of thought leadership for our university. It just so happens that over the last 2 years, Amazon has basically poached 5 individuals from higher education to come work for them. Right? And you can track this. This is all kind of publicly available if you know where to look. All 5 of those people are what we would call delivery and content experts. They're not former presidents that are going to come in and talk about whatever. They're not IT people. They're not professors. They are literally people who make their living studying how to scale content and teaching and learning online, right? So that's interesting. So they're doing something, right? And again, this allows you to be part of shaping that. See, I know that. I kind of understand that. So what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to spend time with people from Amazon. For sure, I kind of want to get to know what they're doing, and so we do a lot of that at the university. I'm going to kind of keep my finger on the pulse of that. I'm going to think about kind of how we would differentiate against that kind of thing. But again, thinking into the future allows you to do this. So this is kind of the bread and butter here of what we're going to talk about today. So I want you to really kind of orient yourself around this chart. I'm going to explain to you kind of what this means. So first of all, whether you realize it or not, every day you are probably encountering or grappling with 4 things when you think about kind of the future of your organization or strategic planning. You're looking at trends. There is a trend happening around us. People are going to college online. People prefer this. This is happening. That is happening. People are buying this, doing this. These are trends. These are just kind of things that you observe out there. They can be tracked over time. They can be measured. There's whole market research firms out there that publish trend reports. all kinds of things happening. There's also called something called signals, and we're going to talk in, later on in this session about signals and signal tracking. Signal's not really a trend. A signal's kind of a quick hit. It's something that you observe out there that seems to have some sort of bigger potential than what it really is. But it's usually on the fringe. So when I tell people, you know, when you start doing this work, I often say, make friends with the fringe. Right? So one of the things that I've been doing recently is I've been studying Burning Man. Is anyone familiar with this? It's this incredibly bizarre thing where all these people, usually very wealthy people, usually tech executives, people from Google and Amazon, sort of go to the desert and just live in tents. And it's this almost tribalistic type of thing. It's incredibly odd. That's a fringe thing, but believe it or not, there's actually something significant going on there. It's like community values, this is actually influencing the tech roadmap for a lot of big products. It's creating these new communities of executives. That's kind of the fringe, right? You want to study that if you do. You kind of want to understand kind of what's going on there. There's also stabilities. These are things that give you hope at night, right? They are the stabilities. They are the things that I could also say, well, yeah, but, you know, we're an accredited institution. Higher education doesn't move very fast. We're located in a town that's kind of cool and hip, and, you know, students keep coming. Okay, good. Well, those are stabilities, right? You got to balance that, right? You want to have stabilities in the mix. And then you have what we call forces. These are big, mega types of things that are just sort of coming at you. Global poverty, climate change, economic uncertainty, like big things that you don't even really have a category for. They're what we would call wicked problems. Right? They're not really addressable problems. They're just things that you're very aware of. So your institution, you got to think about these, right? So you're grappling with these, right? So you got kind of three approaches, these things that you can do. You do what I just call kind of day-to-day management, right? Keep the lights on, run the place. If you notice here on the x-axis, you're dealing with, on the one hand, a time horizon. So often day-to-day types of things are things that are more immediate. Someone walked in, they need something, here it is. These are kind of the needs of our current students. This is kind of your operational layer of the organization. But notice that the day-to-day world typically deals with things that are far more certain. Make sense? So it's kind of, you know, this is kind of the world of certain, it's kind of what you know, right? So then organizations have now, over the past few decades, begun to do something that we generally refer to as strategic planning. So strategic planning, by the way, is something you all do. I'm sure everyone here has a strategic plan. Believe it or not, it's actually kind of a novel concept. It really only became a thing in the 70s and kind of early 80s with firms like Boston Consulting Group and McKinsey that started doing this work, and then higher education kind of embraced that in the early 90s. It's actually, again, still kind of a new thing. It's actually not as radical as it might seem. So what a strategic plan typically does is you look out about 5 years or 10 years, you come up with metrics, you study your organization, and you basically present to your board, or I guess you guys are the board, so you present, people present to you, and then, you know, people present to your accredited advisor, here's what we're gonna do, this is our plan, and we think that if we do this kind of thing, then we're gonna get to a certain place. Great thing, keep doing it, every institution does it. There's a problem with that. Strategic plans are usually a little bit more time-bound, and they typically still deal with things that you're relatively certain about. So here's the challenge. If we're in this world where increased uncertainty, big mega forces, things are happening, things are changing, you actually need another tool in your tool belt. And that's what we call kind of foresight strategy. So what is that? So strategic foresight, basically I describe it, it's a process of turning facts about the present into clear and actionable views of the future. So foresight is actually really about understanding your present and then developing a hypothesis about what you think that might mean for the future. I'll explain to you in a little bit what that means. A few principles that you always want to keep in mind, kind of rules of engagement when you're doing this work. The future does not exist, unless there's some Wesleyan theological something out there. But the future does not exist. It doesn't have, you don't know. Nobody knows. Right? So here's the deal. I don't care who you are in this room. You'd be very successful, lots of degrees, really important person. You are no different than anyone in the room. Why? Because you actually also don't know the future. Right? So it kind of neutralizes the conversation. It's like, thank you, you know, president. That's wonderful, but you might be wrong. Sorry. Right? There are also lots of different possible futures. So believe it or not, and I always kind of say this from the vantage point of your institution. So your institution actually only has 4 possible futures. So over the next 10 years, let's take Indiana Wesleyan University, right? So Indiana Wesleyan has, there's 4 possible things that could happen to Indiana Wesleyan University. It could completely transform itself, become a whole new something, right? It could continue to grow at its existing pace, really kind of change nothing, just kind of continue to fulfill, and it could just continue to grow. It could fall into complete and utter collapse and ruin, kind of like Back to the Future 2. You remember that? Biff's, you know, kind of the whole neighborhood, you know, spray paint all over the walls. You could do that. Or it could just continue to maintain the status quo and do nothing. Right? So we could either look entirely the same. It could go completely downhill. It could completely just grow and blow everyone's away, or it could transform itself in some way. There are literally only four things that could happen. Right? So what you do when you do this kind of foresight strategy is you actually start to develop kind of an app for each of those possibilities, right? So if that happens, we actually were ready for that. We've thought about that. Or, you know, assuming no one wants to, you know, experience utter ruin and despair, well, we've actually imagined what that world might look like. We've actually constructed that picture, and we're actually now developing a thoughtful strategy for how to mitigate against that. Also recognizing the futures are constantly in flux, so that could also change. All right. If you're interested in where this comes from, by the way, a lot of this comes from a really good book called Thinking About the Future. And I often want to point this out because, again, you go back to your campus, you start talking about futurist thinking. Again, people start thinking about the Matrix, and, you know, you might have thought that I was going to show you crazy clips of science fiction. It's not what this is. It's literally just like McKinsey business strategy that you're doing, but you're just doing it in a way that's a little bit more mindful of uncertainty and things that are not possible. The key to keep in mind, and this is the kind of the key recommendation from this book, foresight strategy is meant to do two things. It's meant to be very persuasive, you might say provocative. It's also meant to be accessible. So when you leave here, the one thing that you have to promise never to do is do not form a foresight committee. And it's just the, you know, kind of coalition of the willing, all the real powerful, important people sitting in a smoke-filled room, even though, no, you don't smoke, right, and saying that's not what this is. This is a radically inclusive process. It should include, it should really be practiced across the whole of an institution, and it should really be something that you begin to inculcate across. It's really more of a way of life, if that makes sense. So keep that in mind as well. I think that's one of the problems with strategic plans is they're typically written by people who don't do those things. Sorry, but they are. Someone sat down and wrote something, and chances are that person has actually never spent time recently in the classroom. They really don't have a keen sense of what the needs are. They're really not understanding the community. They're just literally trying to tell you probably, and you guys are board members. I don't usually speak to a lot of boards. They're kind of just telling you what you want to hear, right? So you got to really kind of push that a bit. And one way you can do that is through these practices. Okay, so let me show you this. So one of the things that we're going to do, and here in a moment, you're all going to stand up, and half of you are going to hate me for this, and some of you are going to love it. I'm going to show you an exercise. It's a really kind of easy, fun, accessible exercise that you can do, you can take back to your organization, and this is a way to really kind of get people into a futures mindset. It's called orienting towards the future, or I would also describe it as taking a stand. So if you can stand up, and what you're going to do is you're going to form a line from each corner, so a diagonal line all the way across this, across the room. Don't worry about where you are at this point. Just line up, third grade style. All right, so what this is, it's a method for identifying where we all stand relative to the future, what we think, and increasingly it's kind of important to think about how empowered you feel, or someone kind of, to push back a little bit in the last session, how able or how engaged you feel, kind of what's your role in kind of shaping the future. So what this does, so I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and then what you're going to do is you're going to line up. So you're actually going to shuffle around a little bit. All right, so here's the first question. In the next 10 years, I see the world getting better, or I see the world getting worse? Now, I'm going to force a little bit of precision here, okay? What you cannot do is, you know, bundle up as the murky middle or the extremes on either end, right? Do your best to line up in a straight line. If you see the world getting better, you are on this side of the continuum. If you see the world getting worse, you are on this side of the continuum. Make sense? Okay, go. Okay, so And one thing I do want to note is that I usually do this over the course of a whole day, so I'm going to move very quickly here. So I'm not, this is a little bit of a train-the-trainer type of thing, so we'll experience this, but the idea is that you can take us back. Okay, so let's start with the negative folks, the doomsday scenarios over here. So you see the world getting worse. What does that mean? Okay. Okay, so biblical text would lead you to think that the world's actually getting worse, not getting better. Okay, what does that mean? Like, just construct that a little bit. Like, maybe someone else. Like, what do you see? Why are you standing kind of where you are?
More regulated.
Okay. This is more regulated. What else?
Wars.
Yep. Yep. Seem to be kind of the norm, right? So it kind of leads you to what you would probably describe as a fairly cynical or at least skeptical kind of view of what the world looks like. Now over here, different point of view. So our optimists over here. What do you think?
Opportunities.
Okay.
Creativity.
Okay.
Innovation.
Okay, so you're seeing these things happening, right?
But with some pain.
Okay, but with a little pain.
That's what I meant here.
I hear you.
Okay,
so you're looking at that kind of research, you're saying actually things are getting better in many ways, okay? I've been reading a lot on generational differences, so I'm a Gen X, which means that I just am just cynical and but kind of hopeful and kind of not hopeful, and I'm kind of a mess, right? But there's a lot of, you know, discussions about kind of how this works. What about in the middle?
Both realities are true,
but
there's hope in the midst of the chaos.
Yeah, okay. Anyone else? Yep. So the way that you could structure this, if I was to kind of segment the group, and again, this is not to, I mean, you might be thinking, well, actually, I should be over here. It's not to be reductionist at all, but, you know, it's kind of, okay, so on the one hand, we have the view of just utter kind of hopelessness and despair. Here, we have a view of struggle. And here, we have a view of hope, right? Okay, so think about this for a moment. If this group was to sit down and write a strategic plan right now for an institution, you would all be coming at it from very, very different points of view. Now, I think that's a good thing, can be a good thing, but without first identifying what is your actual orientation and view towards the future, you're not going to get anywhere unless you do this. Now, the value of this exercise, too, and we're going to do one more after this, but the value of this exercise is that it forces you to actually take a stand, right? We don't like this. Sometimes people actually really don't like this, and then sometimes we have people that can't wait to do that, so I've got, you know, kind of everyone. I got people on my team that would just blow the place up if they had the choice, and I've got people that, you know, just think everything's hunky-dory, right? So again, but it forces people to really kind of take a stand. Make sense? All right, so let me show you one more. You know, same thing. Gets a little bit more subjective. I am personally able to affect the future versus I am not able to affect the future. So if you feel like you are able to actually affect or change the future, then you're going to kind of line up here. And if you feel like you have no control, you're going to be here. And we're going to try to line up as evenly as possible. Okay, go.
Is this in our personal sphere or the world?
It's just in your personal sphere. Like, you feel like when you look out to the future, you feel like you have some measure of control, you can shape it. All right. I don't know why I keep harping on the Wesleyan thing. Sorry, I wonder if a bunch of Calvinists were in the room. They're going to be like old. Okay, so they'd be like out in the other room. Yeah, it's good. It's where they belong. So they, if you go, okay, so let's start here. So why, Keith, what's your point of view here?
Nobody's an island. Basically, anything that I want to accomplish in my life, I have to accomplish in some sort of sense of community.
Yep.
I look around here and see declining confidence in institutions of all sorts and declining social capital at all levels among all groups. Mm-hmm.
Okay, okay. Opposite end of the spectrum. Evelyn, you changed places.
If I can disciple well one person.
There you are, yeah.
I can change the future.
Okay. Yep. That's still, by the way, a narrative of struggle. Because that's hard, right? So you're kind of coming at it from, boys, we can do it. It's going to be hard. right? Whereas there's also the point of view of, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not saying that's what you're, but I'm saying that that's another point of view. Listen, guys, we could come up with all the plans. We could invest as much as we want. We could do this. It's not going to amount to anything, right? Or, you know, hey, I think we can do this. It's just going to take some work. And then you have, you change places.
I
love it.
I
love it. I love it. I like to observe this. I do this all the time. I did this last year at Georgetown University. We got asked to go down and do this faculty training thing. It was quite funny, actually. So I had a guy in the room who was a statistician, and he just completely objected to this entire exercise. And he's like, these are not statistically, and he stood in the middle. He's like, he's not pleasant about it. But I got his point, right? Okay, but again, let's not overthink it here. But then I had people that were all over the place. So, okay, so you're here. What do you think? Personally able to affect.
I'm in charge. I can make myself happy.
Yeah.
I'm in control.
Yep. Okay.
We're in education. Of course we're going to make the future better.
Okay. It's kind of our job.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in partnership with the Spirit.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Who can take nothing.
Yep.
And turn it into one.
Yep. Okay.
Okay.
They believe that there's something bigger than ourselves, than some work.
Yep. Yeah. All right. So again, the obvious here. If this group was to sit down and lead an institution in a certain direction, you'd actually approach it from very different perspectives. Right? So what this does in a way is it kind of neutralizes that in a way. At least you kind of know where your colleagues stand. And again, if you all were to actually go and execute, like at SNHU, for example, we will do this work and then we'll actually sit down and roll up our sleeves and do work together. I would encourage you to look around the room. I would encourage you to get together and have coffee. Not so you can change each other's minds, but so you can better understand.
Can I make a very specific point here?
Yeah.
And maybe I'm the only one who looked at this question carefully. I am able to personally affect the future.
Mm-hmm.
The question would be very different if you had asked or said, we are able to collectively.
Yep, yep.
It would have been a very different.
Yeah, yeah. So again, surfacing all these different insights. One of the things we talked about last time, and this is just something, I mean, given your context, so from the picture of a board member, right, a lot of times you might say, well, actually, I feel like I do have quite a bit of authority over control over what happens in the institution. So then the question is often, well, what about those that don't, right? So that's always the challenge, right? So, you know, yeah, but as I interact with people, I'm going to find people that don't feel that level of power or autonomy, right? So then kind of the question is, what do you do about it? So again, this is unexercised. There's a bazillion questions you could ask. You could have people line up on all kinds of them. Usually try to keep them a little bit tame, right? But it allows you, again, to kind of get out of your seat, take a stand, really kind of understand where you stand on these issues. Okay, so have a seat. And while you're doing that, I'm just going to show you a couple other questions that you can incorporate into an exercise like this. And I didn't do this here because, you know, not knowing where you all come from, sometimes this can get really subjective. But you can also ask people, in the next 10 years, I see my institution's world getting better or getting worse. So when I look out to the future of my institution, I'm either hopeful or I'm incredibly dismal and cynical, right? That's an important point of view to surface, right? You kind of have to know that, right? Because if you have, and again, I keep falling back to writing a strategic plan, even though we're talking about moving beyond strategic planning, that strategic plan is going to take a very, very stark turn in one direction or the other, depending on how people are oriented towards the future. So what you often do is you just allow these things to be completely muted and you just don't touch them, or you actually dig in and allow these to kind of shape the way you're thinking about the future of the institution. You could also say, kind of in my current position, I feel empowered, or I don't feel empowered, right? So again, another question that I think, you know, can be useful. Thoughts on this exercise? And again, to your point, I mean, sometimes it's how you ask the question, right? You got to be really mindful of that, and then it allows you to really, again, kind of surface that, right? And again, this isn't a right or wrong thing. In fact, in an ideal state, if you have someone who says, whoa, I don't agree with that at all, this is the stupidest thing ever, great, now we know, right? Because if we didn't know that, then we'd get 6 months down the road through this process and have no idea where you stand. Does that make sense? So again, it's a tool, something that you can kind of incorporate. All right, so when you start to do foresight strategy, there's actually a ton of different exercises that you can do. So SNHU works very closely in partnership with a couple of organizations. One is the Institute for the Future, which is a Palo Alto-based think tank that does a lot of kind of futures work. They actually were spun out, I believe, in the 70s from the RAND Corporation, so they've done a lot of kind of big military and defense advising. But they've been very helpful for us in kind of thinking about and kind of embodying a lot of these strategies for our institution. We also work with an organization called the Center for Creative Leadership in North Carolina. They're super thoughtful. If you ever have a chance to bring your people down there, it will be worth every dime, I promise you. Really get you into the mindset of thinking about what you do and, again, the creative potential behind what you do. Now, I often, you know, I could actually go in either direction. I tend to find myself probably a little bit more on the hopeful side because I think that the creative potential for what we can do should never be understated, right? It should be balanced, but it shouldn't be understated. So, again, this allows you to kind of get into that frame. All right, so let's take a step in a different direction because I want to show you another tool. This is a tool that we call combinatorial forecasting. Combinatorial forecasting, excuse me. It's been a long day. Combinatorial forecasting. Use that next time you're in a meeting. You'll sound really smart. You're really cool. Basically, combinatorial forecasting is the process of looking out into the world around you and picking up signals, things that you see, what is that, and taking those and using those as a way to combine and to construct a view of the future or to construct the view of some new possibility. So I'm going to show you how to do this, and then you're going to actually build a combinatorial forecast at your table. All right. So let me just show you kind of what this is and how this works. Okay. So this is research from the RAND Corporation many, many years ago, 1971. Actually, Institute for the Future and RAND produced this report. It was kind of a real kind of heavy, kind of intense dossier. I believe it was produced for the retail and kind of consumer space. And what they were doing is they were looking at signals, things that they were observing in 1971, and they were coming up with projections of what they think future possibilities might be. Again, I want to remind you, this was in 1971. So again, obviously the logos are placed there so we can imagine what that possibility is today. So they were looking out at the retail world, and they were tracking something called shopping transactions. This may seem so obvious to us today, but 1971, this was actually kind of a crazy idea, that there were these things called store catalogs. And they were actually consolidating a lot of purchasing options all into one place and leading to these kind of rapid scale transactions that were kind of unlike anything the industry, at least at that time, really knew. Right? Now, they didn't know what that was going to become, but you could say that they predicted in some phase what today we would know as things like Amazon or Zappos. Person-to-person work. They were tracking work patterns, and they were looking at this idea, and again, 1971, crazy novel concept. There could be a reality or a future one day where people actually get paid to work in their home. Right? Like, they could not be in an office. So companies like IBM actually took this and went crazy with it and actually went too far with it, right? But this was a trend. This was something, again, that they were kind of looking at. Now, they were stitching together a lot of phenomenon, a lot of ideas, and, again, kind of building a hypothesis. They were also tracking this idea of taking plays or movies and kind of consolidating them into these kind of centralized video libraries. So that became probably what in the 80s was Blockbuster. Right? Believe it or not, again, crazy idea. That's a crazy novel concept. You're going to take all this entertainment and you're going to put it into one retail operation and kind of distribute it in this way. And then that, of course, morphed into online learning platform, online platforms. Again, things like Netflix, HBO Go. Does this make sense? See how kind of, sort of see how this works? Right? So again, it's 1971. They're just looking at things. Like, all I know is that I'm seeing an increase in the number of people who are doing their job from home. What does that mean? I have no idea. I just know that that is happening. So once you just start thinking about this, because you're seeing things now, you read the news, engage in your community, there's signals, there's little kind of hits here and there. Let me kind of show you what this means. Okay, so first of all, when I say a hit, this is something that you see when you scan your surroundings for evidence of a future happening today. A signal is often something that's very small or kind of local in nature. So again, make friends with the fringe. Pay attention to things that people may not normally notice. It's usually a product or a service. It can be an initiative, a policy, something new that's happening around you, with the potential to affect others around it. right? So a signal is something that you look at and you say, there's something really significant there. It seems pretty small or insignificant now, but if you were to really kind of scale that thing up, it could change the world. Does that make sense? Okay, let me give you a little bit more. So it's something happening that you instinctively feel will kind of move the world or a market or your institution in a different direction. What that direction is, you don't know. Again, potential is size, scale. So what can a signal actually be? So it can be a product, it can be a service, it can be a technology, or it can be a policy. Now, again, think about this. It can be a product, and it can be like something that people use in some way. It could be kind of some service, something that morphs. It could be like a tool or a technology. The key to a signal is that you want to assign a little bit of narrative to it. So let me just show you an example of some signals. All right. So New York adopts free tuition. This is a signal. This is something that is not common. It's fairly novel. It's happening right now in kind of a localized way. It's happening in different states, right? But it's a signal that would suggest that if you were to scale that up to some kind of enormous impact, it could actually completely change and disrupt the entire industry of higher education, right? If community college became free in all 50 states, it would put most colleges out of business, right? So again, preparing for that, right? Like that's a signal. So let's track that signal. Let's think about that signal. That is a thing that we can spot. Now, notice in the way that you craft the signal. You don't want to say Uber. Okay, Uber is not a signal. The way people use Uber is a signal. So the way you would describe the signal is people are now hailing taxi cabs using their smartphone using an app called Uber. That's a signal. Does that make sense? So again, because you're going to construct this here in a moment. Okay, so there are now earbuds that you can use that can translate languages in real time. So I go to Germany, I don't speak German, I can configure these, and then I can actually be talking to someone, they could be speaking in German, and it translates for me in real time. This is happening. This is a product that is in the market that can be used. And so what would you call this signal? You know, you would say something about, you know, people now use earbuds, there's now earbuds available to translate languages in real time. Make sense? Do not use really clunky academic, just real basic vernacular. Hey, this thing is happening and it seems significant for this reason. Another is this. So anyone know what Twitch is? What is Twitch? Yeah. So it's an online platform that gamers use. It has several use cases. Mainly, I will get on, I will play a game, and you will potentially even pay money to watch me play that game and kind of learn all the tips and tricks and cheats and all that kind of stuff. This has ballooned into an enormous enterprise. It was purchased by Amazon 2 years ago, and I think has tremendous potential to change the way we learn online. Twitch looks and feels a lot like a learning management system. It incorporates aspects of social learning. It has a certain pedagogy to it. There's kind of teaching and learning practices that happen. It's also an economic engine, so people get paid a lot of money. So, in fact, there are people out there, and again, it's pretty fringe. It's not common. It's kind of like the YouTube stars or the, you know, I mean, this is happening, right? So people are actually doing things online and getting paid enormous amounts of money to do that. Again, completely unheard of in 1971, completely unheard of probably in 2001. Now it's actually an increasingly more common thing. That's a signal, right? That's something that you go, ooh, there's more to that than just a bunch of gamers online having a good time. If this thing were to scale up in some way, it would actually change a lot of things, right? Change the way people learn, the way people make money, all these different things. Here's a couple of examples, and this is what I want you to kind of model on as you think about some signals. So a couple other signals, things that we've collected at SNHU. IBM is offering $200,000 to developers to create tech solutions for natural disaster relief. This is actually happening right now. So if you can think about natural disaster relief once being the work of government agencies and government organizations and non-government organizations and local municipalities and, you know, big firms that come in and defense, well, now this is something that's being kind of what we would call crowdsourced. So companies are actually just looking to everyday people to come up with solutions to big, big challenges. If I am the federal government, I'm very concerned with this. or I'm very optimistic about this. But this actually, if I'm FEMA, all of a sudden I'm looking at IBM and going, what are you guys doing over there? Right? You're hiring, you know, 25-year-old people to come in and start creating whole new natural disaster scenarios and all this kind of stuff. So again, if I'm smart, I'm at FEMA, I'm clued into this. I'm thinking about this. It's a signal. I'm tracking it. Amazon bought Whole Foods. This is big. This is much bigger than just changing the way you get groceries. Though I have to say, we love Amazon Go, and it's a tremendous convenience, but it's actually, it's interesting, right? So if you want to control the world, you start with things people buy, right? You start with maybe knowledge, like books, maybe, I don't know. Then you move into like, you know, Tide sticks and granola bars. And then you start getting into food distribution, right? And then you move into healthcare, right? So again, you want to track this stuff. Kind of think about this. If I owned, so up in the Boston area, we have a grocery store chain called Stop and Shop. I'm sure you have a Albertsons or Kroger's or something like that. This is really concerning to me. This is a real problem, actually. And if I'm an executive at Kroger and I'm not clued into this, I may one day wake up and find myself out of business, right? So foresight strategy, get ahead of this, right? It doesn't catch you by surprise when these things happen. And in fact, you're able to actually codify and make a plan. What else? AI is now being used to generate virtual jokes. I could go a whole bunch of different ways. An NBA team is using virtual reality to evaluate players at the draft. That's happening. Again, something that's occurring. Companies now say they no longer show preference for a bachelor's degree. So that's happening, right? I don't know what that means, but if we were to scale that up to epic proportions, it would be a real, real interesting time for a lot of us, wouldn't it? So when you do combinatorial forecasting, it's basically like kind of a platypus. It's kind of an evolutionary concept where, you know, the platypus is kind of four different animals kind of all combined into one. So what you want to do is you want to imagine taking all of these different signals and then combining them to create some new possibility. So, for example, if I was to say, okay, let's take Amazon buying Whole Foods and an NBA team using virtual reality to evaluate players, right? That's telling me that there's some new future possibility if those two kind of got together and had a baby. What would it be? And this is where you have to be very imaginative and very creative, right? Okay, so here's another way of thinking about it. So in 1993, most of us, we might have owned some variation of all of these different things, right? In 2013, the iPhone, right? So what are you seeing here? So in 1993, if I'm Sony, I'm actually very worried if I'm tracking signals, right? Because I'm observing my customers with like 12 gadgets and it's real clunky and it's a lot, they're kind of a lot of money and they break and this is actually a really, really kind of complicated line of business that I'm in, right? So I'm starting to think about, well, what could potentially happen to change or kind of disrupt my industry? Well, you know, a company like Apple could come along and start looking at consumers and saying, wait a second, you own a lot of things. What if I was to take your phone and I was just to put a little camera on top, right? And then I was also to like embed some kind of calendar feature. And well, we already got the camera there. I guess we could just add like a video feature. And before you know it, you've displaced most of this technology, right? So one thing that you could have done in 1993, if we're doing combinatorial forecasting, is I could have looked at all those things and said, what would happen if I combined all of those into one thing? What would it look like? Make sense? So important, incredibly important to keep in mind. Okay, so let's do this. So this is how it works. You're going to take signal, 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 and you're going to create one new possibility. What I want you to do to start is I want you to sit for a moment and just on your piece of paper or whatever for you, I want you to just jot down a few examples of signals. Again, remember, they're not one-word statements. They're kind of like a description. It's not a long description, but, you know, Amazon bought Whole Foods. People are hailing cabs using mobile phones. You know, people are taking pictures of themselves using long selfie sticks. Things like that, right? Like, that's the kind of stuff. So jot down a few examples of some signals. All right, so I hate to rush you, but I'm going to rush you. You only gave me so much time. Okay, so assuming you have maybe one or two signals, what I want you to do now with your table is you're going to imagine some possibilities. So if you think about it in this way, let's say IBM offering $200,000 to developers, an NBA team using virtual reality, And, oh, here's another one, too. I didn't include this before. A 24-year-old hitchhiking across America and streaming the whole thing on Twitch. These are just three things that are happening in the world. I don't, you know. Now, how do they connect? Well, I mean, here's one possibility. Tech companies bid to hire college grads whose abilities show promise for combating climate change. You see how those could combine to create that possibility? So think about this for a moment with your table. We're going to go pretty quickly, and I'm sorry, but I just want to at least give you the chance to kind of think about that. Take at least two signals at your table and imagine what a future possibility would be if you were to combine those. So we'll do about five or so minutes on this. All right, so let's bring this back. And again, I'm rushing you because, well, one, they only gave me this much time. But two, again, a little bit of a train the trainer, kind of introduce you to some of these exercises. Hopefully you're seeing, this is actually, I think, an incredibly invigorating and creative exercise that you can do tomorrow. It's not really hard to do. One of the things that institutions are doing increasingly, it's something that we're not really doing at SNHU, but I know, for example, I have a friend at Davidson College in North Carolina who does this work, is you can actually recruit students to track signals, right? So it can be actually an incredibly invigorating and inclusive exercise to have students, and so you can do something like a kind of open mic night or a jam session or an innovation roundtable where you actually start having students. You kind of teach students kind of how this stuff works, and they actually become kind of your on-ground researchers to construct some sort of database or list of signals that you could use as an institution. Again, really powerful idea. It gets people engaged, and then it provides for you kind of a lens into what that is. And then it's really your job as board administrators to really come through and actually start to imagine for the institution what new possibilities could be emerging. Right? So you're really the combinatorial forecasters, but you're using your community to really help kind of inform that process. Really, really powerful, can be a really invigorating exercise. So did anyone come up with a combination? Did you make it that far? We had one in the last group. Anyone have the start of a combination? Yeah, you guys were killing it over here. What did you guys come up with? People are sharing bikes. Yep, sharing economy. Yep.
So you see a lot of times dog walking service, pets on planes, almost a rent a pet for comfort, that kind of a thing. Relationship across disciplines, relief from social media, and kids using all the technology together.
Yep. Yep.
So,
all right.
Resolve.
Yeah.
So we can call it Puffer instead of.
There you go. That's it. So, yeah, so I thought that. So again, and you can almost think of it. So entrepreneurs, by the way, do this all the time. So if you're trying to come up with a startup, let's say you quit your day job and go start a company, start doing combinatorial forecasting. You'll come up with all kinds of possibilities. So Uber, literally, so these guys are, or Airbnb is probably a better example of literally a bunch of people who were sitting in an apartment in San Francisco started recognizing that, okay, one, housing prices and accommodation prices are crazy high in this city. Two, we have a sofa right there. That's a signal. There is a sofa in my living room that is not being used. You could, in some way, probably think. And three, people are willing to pay, or people are coming to San Francisco for all kinds of experiences and this kind of thing. If I was to combine those three things, I could do what? Well, I could probably create some sort of mobile app that allows people to, right? You see where this goes? So again, it's a very entrepreneurial type of exercise. And again, it allows you, for your institution, to actually start to do some real solutioning. Right? It's a constructive exercise. And I think it's really good too, because I think, again, can't underestimate the importance of kind of bringing people together and allowing them to kind of, you know, sometimes we call this brainstorming. It's really more kind of game storming. It's creating a very kind of engaging experience. Anyone else come up with the start of a signal besides pooper? As long as you don't bring a peacock on a plane. I saw that article. I travel a lot and boy, interesting. All right, so again, it's kind of two exercises orienting towards the future. I also wanted to show, you've got a few more minutes here, because sometimes people will ask, okay, so how is SNHU, like what are you actually doing with this? So believe it or not, we have operationalized this type of stuff to death. We do this all the time. It's typically done at kind of executive or administrative level, but increasingly we're doing a lot of this work across the institution. So it's kind of the blend of what we would call top-down versus bottom-up innovation. Kind of I sit in the middle of where those two meet. So we have actually created an operational unit. That's what I direct for the university. It's called the Sandbox Collaborative, as I mentioned. And our job really is to do this. So we're kind of a clearinghouse for forecasting. We do have a very, very large signals database that we've collected. It's an enormous spreadsheet. It's not really glamorous, but it just kind of allows us to start to group things and think together. And then, of course, we also produce a lot of research and other things for the institution to help inform our leaders. Where this work has led us is to kind of a strategic vision for the university. And so this is part of our most recently minted strategic plan. This is what we've told our accreditors, our community. This is what we've told the world we are now doing as an institution. So as we look out, we call it future-proofing. We have to future-proof our institution. And we're going to do it in these three ways. First of all, reliance on future planning methods. So what we're doing today, we have to do often as an institution. We do this at a board level. So our board recently went, our board takes these kind of excursions, so they don't do a board meeting on campus. They typically go to Puerto Rico or to Birmingham, Alabama or to Boston or something, and it's kind of an engaged meeting. It's a very small board. And very, very, very engaged board. They're very, very engaged at the strategy level of the institution. But we have to apply these, right? So our board members, all the way down to the whole institution, really needs to be comfortable and familiar with foresight methodologies, and we need to use this all the time. The second is employing what we call digital talent or synthetic colleagues. This type of futurist work has led us to the realization that for us to be strategic in the future, we're going to have to leverage a much broader set of tools than just our brains and a bunch of consultants. We're going to need to use AI and chat-based interfaces. We're going to need to use kind of more complex forecasting models and strategies. So if you can imagine a use case of strategic planning with something like an Alexa in the middle of the room. Something to ask questions, something to offer advice, something to pull best practices, but again, increasingly relying on our, quote, kind of synthetic colleagues. And three is the concept of willful disruption. We are actively trying to put ourselves out of business, because if we don't, somebody else will. And this is probably kind of one of the more provocative ones, but I always kind of like to leave us with this notion of, you know, and particularly if you're in the position of a board, I don't know what it's like to sit on a board of a college, but if I was a board member, if I was in your position, I would be finding every way I could to put this college out of business. And I would bring that to the table. Not in a destructive way, you don't want to be a jerk about it, but as a way of saying, if I was to come in today and put this place out of business, how would I do it? Get out ahead. It's kind of like knowing your enemy in a way, right? But understanding what are the practices, what are the things that we can implement that could actually potentially compete with ourselves and completely upend and change our whole business. So SNHU recently acquired a company. It's kind of a learning platform called LRNG. It's a place-based community learning organization that works in cities across America, delivering kind of just-in-time learning experiences leading to micro-credentials, badges, nano-degrees, things like that. It's not a university, but it's a learning model that's out there. That we think if we were to take and really scale would take share from our existing online programs. So we would lose online students for this very low cost, probably free learning experience. But again, if we don't do that and we don't get out ahead of that, somebody else will. So again, this concept of willful disruption, I often like to end with this because as you take this back, this is not all just unicorns and rainbows. This is really, really provocative stuff, and it really forces an institution to ask some very tough questions, and so much so that, I mean, again, we've told the world as an institution, our accreditors, everyone under the sun, we are actively trying to disrupt ourselves because we know that that's kind of what the future holds for our industry and for our world. So kind of leave you with that. And then I think just one more thing, if you want to kind of reflect on this on the way out, but I often kind of say, okay, what is the next steps? Like, what would you do? Like, if I was in your position, leave here. Never lose sight of the problem. Hopefully everyone, your institutions have pretty crisp problem statements, kind of a clear sense of what you're trying to tackle at this present moment. Develop a process for engaging in foresight strategy. I don't know what that looks like, if it's a board retreat, if it's a, you know, again, you don't want it to be a committee, but it has to kind of be embodied somewhere or in many places across the institution, but really try to integrate this stuff. And then finally, get down to business, because, again, kind of like willful disruption, the clock is ticking. And the future is not always bright for a lot of institutions of higher education, but it is very hopeful, and there are a lot of different possibilities for ways to really put kind of institutions on a very, very solid course. But again, if anything, get down to business, because it's incredibly exciting and invigorating work. So thank you all. This was fun. And I can stick around if you have any more questions, but I don't know if, well, it's 5:30. Yeah.
Three quick tips.
Yeah. Read and note things and write them down. So write things down, develop a practice if it's a journal. Two, crowdsource. So again, having students, having your staff, having your friend, you know, create opportunities to actually, you know, it's almost like a, you know, maybe you have a small group for Bible study in your house. I don't know, create a signals party. You know, we're all going to sit around for 2 hours and we're all just going to amass different signals, right? And we're going to do this work. And then I think the third would be to test those in really rigorous ways, sharpen the signals, right? Actually, there's four. And then the fourth would be, again, collecting those and then putting those into some sort of digestible format where you can start to analyze them. So if it's a spreadsheet, you know, you can sort by, and you can kind of group signals, like, you know, you could do something like, you could do it by industry. That's one thing that people do. So, you know, aviation, retail, that kind of thing. So it allows you to start to group a little bit. The principle we often refer to is MEESE, mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive. Try to really group things as much as you can so you really get a tight package of different signals, but then go as deep as you possibly can to really understand what's going on. Does that make sense? Yeah. All right. Thank you all so much. Appreciate it. Thank you.